KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Rock Against the TPP, Saturday, August 20th at Director Park in Portland. Rock Against the TPP is an effort to educate and fight against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, an anti-democratic deal between 12 countries that was negotiated in complete secrecy by government officials and hundreds of corporate lobbyists. Rock Against the TPP features Downtown Boys, Evangeline Lilly, Danbert Nobacon from Chumbawamba, Makana, Son of Nun, and many more. Again, that's Rock Against the TPP, Saturday, August 20th at Director Park, 815 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. The concert is all ages and wheelchair accessible, but RSVP is required. More information about how to RSVP, the other performers, and the TPP can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Rags to Riches Jazz Concert and live broadcast on Saturday, August 27th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Holiday Park in Portland. Swing dance lessons start an evening of live music with breaks included for short informational speeches about the life and history of jazz in the early 20th century. Again, that's Rags to Riches Jazz Concert and live broadcast on Saturday, August 27th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Holiday Park between Northeast 11th Avenue and Holiday Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm Don Merrill, and I'm talking with Portland author Carolyn Miller. She's written several books, including Trompe L'Oeil, Heartland, and Gothic Spring. She's a playwright, penning last year's stage drama, Woman on a Scarlet Beast. She has a YouTube book reading series called Just Read It, and she's written a new book called Ballet Noir. Ms. Miller, welcome.
Thank you, Don.
Ms. Miller, for listeners who don't know about you, talk a little bit about your path to becoming a writer based here in Portland.
Well, I think I really always wanted to be a writer. I think most writers, you know, pick up a pen at 6 or 7 as soon as they learn the alphabet and doodle. So my life has largely been an interruption of my goal. You know, one has to eat and one is not going to eat as a writer, for the most part, I should say.
Now, I have to admit that when I went through the book, it reminded me just a little bit of Black Swan, starring Mila Kunis, from 2010. Some critics said that that movie was a psychological thriller. Others said it was about someone trying to reach artistic perfection.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe Ballet Noir?
Well, actually, Ballet Noir is a love story. It's an analysis of love. There is something like 27 or 28 characters in Shakespearean love triangles, and love takes many faces. It's kind, it's loving, it's protective, but it is also competitive, nagging, vicious, and cruel. And the book examines all of the aspects through the relationship of the different characters.
Much of the book is told from your protagonist, Tara Bentley, and it sounds like it's a daily diary entries almost. They seem to be consecutive, like someone on tour.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, actually, now that you mention it, I think almost all of my books are in the first person, because I think that's where we live mostly in life, as first person. So, yes, it is a first person. It is, and I didn't answer your question about the Black Swan, because there is a coming-of-age story here also. As Tara begins as a young 20, 21-year-old woman going out into the world for the first time, and then she discovers a lot about herself, and not all of it is good.
Now, each chapter begins with Tara thinking about wails she hears and premonitions that have always meant death to her. Talk a little bit about that.
That's, of course, the first chapter, which sets the tone of the novel. And then, of course, she begins to hear these voices while she's abroad, and they become more and more intense until she thinks she's losing her mind. And it isn't until the proverbial tall, dark, handsome stranger comes in to tell her, I'm a necromancer, and these voices are real, and you need to confront them, and I'm here to help.
You know, and something else I noticed, a lot of the chapters do not end without the mention of her dead mentor. Why was it important to keep coming back to Yelena Natalova?
Well, of course, Yelena's story is the one that moves the whole novel. She was the teacher of Tara, but before that she was with the Bolshoi and considered one of the great classic ballerinas who escaped to the United States, leaving behind her lover, who destroyed himself as a result. And he pursues Tara throughout the novel as a kind of vengeance for the betrayal of Yelena. So Yelena, even though she's a ghost in the novel, is pivotal.
A lot of your books and a lot of your work seems to follow the same kind of narrative. There's a lot of drama. There's a lot of introspection. You had a review, I think it was a Midwest Book Review, where they talked about how you have a very gothic style. Why is that of interest to you?
Well, people ask me if I plot my novels. I don't. Writing to me is an exposure of the mind. So it would follow that what I write comes out as an inner dialogue, and you're looking for
more. Well, I didn't know if there was.
No, that's it.
You don't seem fixed on one style of writing. I mean, whether it's gothic novels or mysteries or the dynamics of religion and families, you seem to go wherever your pen takes you, but it seems other writers get into a genre and stay there. I think of James Patterson. I think of Sue Grafton. For young writers out there trying to find a style, what advice would you give them?
Boy, I wouldn't take mine. I think, Don, you've hit something that's very critical in commercial selling today, and that is having a brand so that when people pick up the book, it's a formula that they're familiar with and they can escape into. For me, writing is, I think, as you rightly pointed out, a kind of psychological exploration. And so I must do whatever strikes me. And that's not the way to brand yourself and sell books, and so I wouldn't recommend it.
You got a pretty nice review. We talked about the Midwest Book Review. You got a really nice review from them. Talk about that.
Well,
as much as authors, of course, don't want to talk about themselves.
Well, Midwest Book Review is, I'm with a small-ish press. I'm not a big-time, big-five writer with, the big companies. And Midwest Book Review is sort of the New York Times of the small independent presses. So when they wrote that I was the master of the Gothic style, I was pretty pleased. That was a pretty nice compliment.
Now, something else I noticed about that email, because you sent me that email, and I noticed that they have a new policy where they're asking writers to send stamps to help other writers. And that made me wonder, what is the state of the writing profession? I mean, it sounds kind of rough out there.
It is very rough, and I'm glad you brought that up, because what I want to say to people out there who are struggling is that most of us are not going to make money writing. It has to be an act of love.
Are you making money?
No. Let me put it this way. I spent something like $4,000 to edit the book to make sure it was letter perfect, and I get $1.60 per sale. That would be a lot of books. So no, I do not make money. And most writers out there don't, even those whose names you might recognize more readily than mine.
If you don't mind, I'd like you to read from chapter 5 of your book, and I want to set it up. Tara is at a costume party, and she's just finished a dance with someone when she has one of her first clear encounters with her dead mentor, and it has a pretty substantial effect on her. Can you read that?
Just the paragraph? Okay.
Yeah.
This is when Tara is at a mask ball, because I want to tell my audience this is full-blown gothic. Costumes, phantoms, ghosts, cat, you know, the whole enchilada, with Europe as the background, so decadent Europe, if you will. So she is at a masked ball, and here we go. The moment I allowed myself to relax, I began to hear voices. They were calling my name. I wanted to answer, but felt as if I was locked in a tomb. There was something at once terrible and yet wonderful. I recognized one of the voices as it rose above the rest. But how was it possible? Yelena Natalova had been dead for 9 years. I couldn't be hearing her now, and yet I couldn't deny it either.
Carolyn, how long have you been writing?
Well, as I said, you know, as a child.
But writing as in?
Okay. And as if to really get published. Okay. I would say I picked it up seriously in my 70s. As I said, life got in between my passion. And I say that with a little pride, because there must be people out there wanting to write. And as long as the brain is intact, the thing about writing is you can do it at any time. And so I started my career. I published my first novel when I was 73, I think.
Now, I've talked to a lot of artists and writers and musicians, and at some point, they do what they do not for the money or the recognition or to hone their craft, but because they know they're not going to live forever and they want to leave a mark. So why do you write these days? Like, what's your reason?
Well, I don't expect to leave a mark. You know, I'm a second-tiered writer with a small publishing house. I want to share my thoughts with people. And, you know, there's always this classic argument for a writer. Do I want to live for posterity, or do I want to live now and have an interchange with readers now? Definitely, I don't care about posterity. I will be dead in posterity, and I won't know. So, no, I want to write because I want to share my ideas with people now and listen to their minds. You cannot write without interchanging with other people.
When you wrote your last book, did you know there would be a next book?
Actually, I think I'm winding down on novel writing, as satisfying as it is. And it's just pragmatic to sell a book, to promote a book, to gather an audience is extremely difficult. I don't think would-be wannabe writers know how hard it is. And you spend more time trying to sell a darn book than writing it. And so I probably am going to move back to where I came from, which is short stories, where you just send it off, the publisher reads it, says yes, and sends you a check, and the audience is already there.
So then this period of writing books, was that like a bee in your bonnet?
Well, actually, it happened with Heartland, which was 4 or 5 short stories that all got published, and the little character kept coming back, and I kept writing, and I had about 10 or 11 of them, and I thought, I think I'll string these together. So it became a novel that way, and then I thought, I can do this, you know, and so I wrote 3 more.
So it sounds like what you're saying is there aren't too many more books in there.
Oh, no, I could write forever. I don't understand this idea of writer's block. That just is, life is just too full. There are just too many things, and people are just too darned interesting. But I don't want to be a salesman and a promoter. I'm an artist, and so I will go where the art permits me to survive.
You know, they always talk about that. They always say that there's this conflict between the artistic side of the writer and the business side of the writer or the creative. And those two don't usually get along with each other.
Well, they don't, because nowadays there was a time when publishers nurtured writers, you know, and they did your promotion and they believed in you. It's not that way anymore. It's a business. So they'll publish your book. Then they'll say, how many books do you want? And you run around and you try to sell them. And frankly, I'm tired of my friends crossing the street when they see me because they're afraid I've got a book in my pocket. You know. So, no, I don't want to be a commercial person.
But a lot of publishers also want to know, you know, what's your social media reach? And you're pretty active on social media.
Oh, I am indeed. I'm on Facebook and Twitter and Goodreads. And I write a blog called Write Away, R-I-T-E, away, to one word. And that has turned out to be very satisfying because I comment about the writer's life and life in general as other writers see it. So it's I'm dialoguing with people I never meet, but and then the public will come in and comment. So that, too, is a lovely discipline that I've come to enjoy.
Has that bought you any cachet with your publishers to be able to say, I have a social media presence?
The only thing that buys me cachet with my publisher is how many books have I sold. It's a very crass and hard and tough business.
Well, on that note, Carolyn, it's been a pleasure to talk to you again.
I'd love to be with you, Don, always. Thank you.
I'm Don Merrill, and I've been talking with Portland author Carolyn Miller. She's written a new book called Ballet Noir. Miss Miller, thank you very much for the time.
Well, thank you, Donna. It's always a pleasure. I think this is about our second or third interview, so you're very patient to keep letting me come back.
Tune to Arts Express, and next up on the program, Call Mr. Robeson, a theatrical solo show created by African-British performer Tayo Aluko, and which he has brought to stages around the world to honor and celebrate the both creatively triumphant and politically tragic life and legacy of the late actor and activist Paul Robeson, a brutally persecuted victim of McCarthyism in the last century. Aluko phoned in from Vancouver to talk about the production's conception and creation and how Robeson's enduring progressive inspiration resonates today. First, a little from the play Call Mr. Robeson, then Tayo Aluko.
Nobody knows the trouble I've seen.
Paul Robeson, I said. Paul Robeson. No. R-O-B-E-S-O-N.
Glory, alleluia.
They said that I had been struggling for the independence of the colonial peoples of Africa, and that that is meddling in the foreign affairs of the United States government. Now that's too bad, because I'm going to have to continue to meddle. Because my father was a slave, and my people died to build this country, and I'm going to stay here and have a part of it just like you. And no fascist-minded people will drive me from it. Is that clear?
All men revered and all men rever. He must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling. He keeps on rolling along.
She's seen all there is to see from the dawn of time. It's Mother Africa.
You've struggled to perform Call Mr. Robinson for so long and so persistently. Why are you so passionate about Paul Robeson?
I think that Paul Robeson, to me, represents the best of humanity, actually. He was somebody who was blessed with incredible talents, incredible gifts, which made him a lot of money for a long time. But he decided, because of his politics, that he would devote those talents almost entirely for the betterment of the lives of other people. And he did that in the full knowledge that it would get him into a lot of trouble. But he went ahead and did that anyway. His story for me is incredibly inspiring. And it's just one that I feel that I need to share with as many people as possible.
And how did the idea for mounting this production first come to you, and why?
It all started very early one morning on June 23rd, 1995, which was the summer solstice. I live in Liverpool in England, and a small organization had decided to organize an event called the Dawn, to welcome the dawn on the longest day of the year. They asked me to sing, and I chose to sing a song, a spiritual, called My Lord, What a Morning, which I thought was appropriate to be singing at about 6:30 in the morning outdoors among people. And a lady came up to me afterwards and said that I reminded her of Paul Robeson, and she asked if I sang many of his songs. And at that time, I think I knew absolutely nothing about him. I may have heard the name, but then by pure chance, I 2 months later, I was in the library in Liverpool looking maybe at the Black History section or Civil Rights section, and there was this biography on the shelf by Martin Duberman, Paul Robeson, and I borrowed it, read it, and that was it. I discovered a story that, in my opinion, just needed to be told.
Now, there's such an enormous treasure trove of artistic and political material connected to the life and work of Paul Robeson. So how did you conceive as to what to include in your performances or not?
Yeah, that was difficult because, you know, it was, I mean, first of all, he lived for 77 years. There was so much. And eventually what it boiled down to was, you know, I picked out the actual stories and incidents in his life that I thought were particularly interesting that I really wanted to tell stories about. And I also picked out the songs that I found most interesting and I really wanted to sing. I tried to see how I could weave those two together into a coherent piece of drama. So a lot of stories went by the way, a lot of songs went by the way. But actually there was at least one song that hadn't been on my list of things that I wanted to sing, but that also was very crucial in telling the story. So I actually put that in, you know, just a few lines of it. That was a song called The Ballad for Americans, which to me was not very interesting, and also it felt a bit too jingoistic for my liking. But, you know, at the point where he sang it in 1934, I thought it was very crucial to show how patriotic he had been, or and in fact always was, but how he went from that to being seen as totally un-American. So it was quite a feat, and it seems that it's worked well.
And what makes you angriest, and what makes you most sad about what befell Paul Robeson?
Yeah, angriest is actually what the authorities did to him. You know, mainly in the U.S., although he was followed by MI5 in Britain and in Canada and the Royal Mounted Police in Canada, but the surveillance and his actual persecution in the U.S. and that's what makes me most angry. What makes me most sad, two things come to mind. One is the fact that he's really very, almost completely unknown by younger people in the U.S., even many older people in the U.S., even black people in the U.S. don't know him. And the other thing that makes me sad is, you know, the fact that he had this mental health problems, which he received electric shock treatment for, and his son, Paul Jr., was convinced that he was given far too many doses of ECT, and they were all too strong in a deliberate effort to neutralize him. So this is somebody who was, you know, quite a genius in his time, and he was medically neutralized by his government, and that's awful, that's criminal, and sad. But he, you know, when he started off, he knew he was in for a lot of bad treatment, and he bravely accepted it.
What has Paul Robeson meant to you in your own life and growing up?
I'm Nigerian, although I'm now a British citizen, and it's quite remarkable that reading Robeson's biography was one of the things that actually taught me a lot more, or quite a lot, about African history that I had known beforehand, and black history that I had known beforehand. And through him, I actually developed as much pride as I have now in having, you know, in being African. He introduced me, or helped me understand what socialism is, and helped me embrace it as, like he said, you know, fundamentally a great system for humanity. And so he's helped me develop a world outlook which I think more people need to embrace. And it's very interesting to note that Bernie Sanders is, you know, calling himself a democratic socialist, when only a few years ago anybody calling themselves a socialist was asking for trouble, or at best, you know, to be ignored. And you can't ignore Bernie Sanders, certainly.
Now, your website, callmrrobeson.com, what can listeners find there?
They can find listings of my forthcoming performances. They can find listings of my previous performances. And what I do on that particular page is provide links to commentaries that I have made at almost every performance I have done, whereby I write a paragraph which tries to relate Paul Robeson to whatever has been happening in the news in the last day or two, be it in the world or in the area where I have been performing. And I find that really quite a, you know, it's quite a taxing but really interesting task that I have given myself. There is a trailer for the play. Yeah, it's, you know, photographs of me in performance. It's a website which I think is quite useful, quite nice for people to see.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. Coming up next on Art Focus, Joseph Galaban interviews John Gottschall and Megan Patzold about their joint show called Counterpoint at Gallery 114. Before we go to Art Focus, I have a short announcement. Longtime Art Focus listeners will remember the late Julie Bernard, who hosted the program for many years, starting in the 1980s. Julie died last October. Her family is having her funeral and a reception on Saturday, August 20th. The service is at 3 p.m. and reception is from 4 to 7. It is at Elliott Chapel and Buchan Hall at the First Unitarian Church at 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue, downtown. Again, that is the funeral service for Julie Bernard. Now here's Art Focused with host